The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this program are available for free. More than 560 episodes and counting. Your support makes a difference. If you would like to support this program, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Thanks.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jesus, dude, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Okay.
Just one person
right.
And just one
okay.
time.
Hey, this is the Other People right. podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles, California. It is nice to be with you. I have Ingrid Rojas Contreras on the podcast today. Her debut novel is a national bestseller. It's called Fruit of the Drunken Tree. It is available in hardcover from Doubleday, and it is due out in paperback in May of 2019, if I have my dates correct. So very pleased to have had a chance to sit down and talk with Ingrid Rojas Contreras. And I must confess, too, am I supposed to say Ingrid Rojas Contreras when I say a Latina name? Am I supposed to use like the Spanish pronunciation? If I'm being honest, I kind of feel like when a gringo does that, it's a little annoying. It's like, okay, we get it. You took Spanish. You can roll your R's. But I also, you know, what's the right thing to do? I am genuinely perplexed. Sort of like when, you know, I've talked about this, like somebody knows knows French, for example. And, you know, you're like, oh, I went to Marseille. And they're like, oh, Marseille. You know, it's like, okay. Take it down a notch. We get it. You're cultured. So I had an excellent time with Ingrid, and we went for a little walk after the conversation. I showed her where to get food, and then she went and walked around a cemetery. Apparently that's what she does whenever she visits a city. She goes to the cemetery, or to some kind of cemetery, which I find interesting. I got some mail from a listener named Thomas. He says, hey, Brad, I fell asleep while driving the other day. It was about 5 a.m. I was driving home from work. I nodded off in the middle of a highway off-ramp. Luckily, no one was hurt, but I got my car stuck in a ditch. I have fallen asleep behind the wheel a few times now, but this was the first time I drove off the road. I'm scared that I'm going to cause some real damage one day to myself or someone else. Like I'll veer into oncoming incoming traffic or something. But this night, when I ended up in the ditch, I didn't feel afraid or upset. I felt so calm. I felt so grateful that I live in an age when it's so easy to get a tow truck in the scene. 15 minutes and $179 later, I was back on the road. It was painless. The tow truck driver was friendly. He'd just come from North Carolina. Anyway, I don't think muggers should be made to strip naked in the streets. The Thomas Konstam episode 561, gave me a nice case of wanderlust. It's easy to forget that there's a whole world out there that exists apart from my little space. Keep trucking. Thomas. So if I recall correctly, and thank you, Thomas, for writing to me, I have some thoughts to offer here. First of all, with regard to muggers being made to strip naked in the streets, what Thomas is referring to is a little bit of conversation that I had with Thomas Konstam in the last episode, where he was telling me about how he got pistol whipped in Venezuela. I don't even know how we got to, somehow my mind went to, like, the penalty for mugging somebody should be that you have to get naked and like walk home. And I was joking. Kind of. I was like also sort of curious, like, would that work? You know, would that be effective in curbing crime? I don't know. I guess it's also like a violation of rights and humiliating. It would also create like public spectacle that could be upsetting to people. But, you know, I was in the flow of conversation I think you guys get it. It wasn't entirely serious. As for this driving into a ditch, Thomas, I think that you might want to get checked to see if you're narcoleptic. This sounds like narcolepsy to me. If this is happening repeatedly where you're nodding off and driving off the road, then I think you might be narcoleptic, and I think you might need to take medication, particularly when you are driving long distances or driving when you are in a state of fatigue. Because, you're only going to get lucky so many times. And even if you don't get injured, you don't want to hurt somebody else. So I would get that checked out. I say this as somebody who has several, mildly narcoleptic members in my family. My sister's sort of that way. I have an uncle who can just doze off at the dinner table. I have some really good sleepers in my line, which I'm a bit envious of. I kind of wish I could do that. My older sister can sleep anywhere. She gets tired, it's over. She shuts it down. So thank you, Thomas. Take good care of yourself. Drive safely. My guest today is Ingrid Rojas Contreras. Her debut novel, the national bestseller, Fruit of the Drunken Tree, available now in hardcover from Doubleday. Here she is, folks. This is Ingrid Rojas Contreras.
There's something about his face that immediately puts you at ease. And it's also a very large, very large face.
He's got, Seth Meyers has a large face.
Yeah.
How unusually large?
I think so. When I was on stage, one of the things that I was thinking was wow, there's a lot of surface area. there's a lot of room in which for an expression to happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of times people who are gifted comedic performers probably have something interesting in their facial expression. That would make sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but he's incredibly charming, just the nicest person.
And I think he's done not only a good job of bringing writers onto his show, which is something that used to happen in late night comedy TV. Johnny Carson used to do that, but then it sort of fell away a little bit. Letterman did it sometimes. It was the last guest, but I also feel like Seth Meyers has been a pretty sharp critic of Trump, and I don't know. I think he's been pretty astute in a lot of ways and bold, and I don't know.
I'm in love with everything that he's doing on his show. And I used to watch him on SNL, so it was, been seeing him for a long time. And just all the writers that he's had on. I must have seen all the interviews when I, right before going on, just to try to imagine what it would be like. But one of the things that I was not prepared for was there were pasties in the green room. There were tons of really nice.
Wait.
Yeah, like nipple pasties.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't expect that.
I know.
So wait, what are you, there's just a bowl of pasties back there?
Yeah. Which I took and I've been giving to women in need.
Are they branded?
They're Heidi Klum pasties.
What does that even mean?
her name is on the package.
Oh, she has her own brand.
She has her own brand. They're actually really nice. They have a silk. They have a silk.
Well, where's mine? Where do I do?
I should have brought you one.
I would wear some pasties.
Yeah.
I didn't even know. I mean, I knew that pasties existed. I didn't know that Heidi Klum had her own line. And when you originally said it, I thought they said Late Night with Seth Meyers on them or something, like a coffee mug or something. But no.
That would be nice.
But no.
No. There was a coffee mug.
Did you take it?
Yeah. No, I got a whole bag of goodies. It was incredibly nice. There were chocolates in there, a t-shirt, a mug.
Did you get a selfie with him or anything like that?
Yes. And he also wrote me a nice note.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
He's gentleman, top notch.
Now I feel like an asshole for not having a gift bag.
I know. Where's my gift bag?
I should have some other people pasties made. It's on my list now. But this is a great, that's great. That's a great opportunity for you. Did you freak out a little bit backstage? Were you nervous to be on TV?
I did. Yeah. It was very nerve-wracking. I had my mom with me backstage, which was nice, both because she's never understood what I do. And so it was a nice way for her to be like, oh, so you just wrote some words and for some reason...
People are interested in having you on national television.
Waiting to go on stage is just nerve-wracking.
And then once you get out there, did you find any kind of comfort zone? I guess he set you at ease a little bit?
Yeah. Right before going on stage, it was kind of a jarring thing to happen, but it also made me less nervous. There's someone whose job is to just look at your outfit and make sure that everything is in place. And so this woman is looking me up and down, and she goes, it looks like you have a veiny boob. And I was like, what? What do you mean? So I just like started to look down at myself. And the way that they had mic'd me, like the cord of the mic was going over my breast and it was making this veiny boob look.
Yeah.
And so they were ready for us and they were like, yeah, can she come out? And we were like, we have a situation with the mic. And so there were two people who were trying to figure out where to put this cord. And then finally it came to me that if we put it down the middle, it would like disappear because, right, the fabric is flat.
These are the intricacies of being on television and production. I've been through this before, but like there's always like wardrobe people like attending to every little detail of a person's like shirt and like do the buttons align. And these things actually do matter, though. I mean, you kind of want, if you're going to be on camera,
I'm glad that she caught it. And then so that it was fixed and then I was just walking out and that was...
And then
I was on stage.
Okay, so now you're on stage. People are looking at you. The cameras are rolling. Did you experience any kind of like surge of panic? Were you like detectable, like heart thundering in your chest kind of thing? Or did you just zone out and do it?
It was very surreal to be on the set. And then he asked me the first question. I think I like blacked out for a second and then came back and I was like, wait, I'm supposed to be...
Yeah, see, I feel like I would be. I feel like I would be a little bit out of body.
Yeah,
I would be like the self awareness of like, oh my god, I'm on the show. I'm like watching myself on the show as I'm on the show.
Yeah,
is that what happened?
Yeah, that happened. But then and then I kind of like looked around and saw the people in the audience, and then I was like, okay, like I'm here. I have to do this and be present for all of it.
You didn't go through a commercial break with them, did you?
No, we didn't.
I always wonder like what they say. Like I've read about Letterman, like he doesn't even talk to the guest. Like they go to they go to commercial and he's like not even saying anything to them.
Oh wow.
But I mean occasionally you would see him lean over and whisper something or but I'm always interested in that banter, like in between like the actual taping and then when they go to commercial and they're sort of it's a little bit more informal.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't have that moment with him.
No, only at the end he was telling me, I think, I can't remember now, but someone he knew had just gone to Colombia and he was telling me about where they were.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're from Colombia?
Yes.
Born and raised in
Bogota.
Okay, which is like where your book is set. And why don't you, for people who are listening who have not read, give kind of a broad overview of the novel just so people can have kind of like a point of entry?
Yeah. So Fruit of the Drunken Tree is my first novel and it's autobiographical and it tells the story of two girls who are growing up in the 90s. So there's car bombs and kidnappings and Pablo Escobar is in the background. And one girl her family has been displaced by the Civil War, and that's how she comes to Bogota. And the other girl is middle class. So the girl who's displaced comes to work as a maid in the middle class home. So these two girls develop a friendship, but the violence of the country starts to creep in on their relationship until, everything is kind of torn apart.
So what is the, I mean, I know you're from Bogota, you lived through some of this, or at least were, had proximity to some of this, but what about the origin of these characters in your mind? Like, where did the book begin for you creatively?
So it had to do with kind of like the autobiographical bit that the story is based on. So we used to have all these young girls who would stay with us, and they would live with us, and they would be our maid, and they would be our nanny and do maid's work.
So were you raised like middle class or what? Middle class?
Middle class.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so one of these young women happened to be living in guerrilla-occupied territory. And so she started to get threats from the guerrilla groups who had plans to act against our family. So they told her, if you don't, you know, participate in this with us, we will start to kill your family or we will hurt you. And so she was 15 when that happened, and I was 13. And, you know, ever since then, I never stopped thinking about what it would be like to be so young and to have that kind of responsibility in your shoulder, on your shoulders.
Well, to have like an impossible choice.
Yeah. So I based the book on two girls who come from different worlds, whose lives kind of become entwined.
Why did the guerrillas want to act against your family? Is this just extortion?
Yeah, it's, at the time, kidnappings were really common in Colombia. And so I think it was something like 1 in 5 people would get kidnapped. So, yeah. So you don't even have to have a lot of money. Basically, it was the way that the guerrillas were funding their war against the government. So they would take, you know, whoever. And some people would be returned, you know, that the family would pay the money and then the person would be returned. Other people disappeared. They never came back. Other people were held for, you know, up to 30, 50 years.
Did you know people? Who?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Who?
Well, my uncle was kidnapped twice, for a long time. And my dad was kidnapped, but he got really lucky. A guerrilla group kind of caught him right after he was, getting off from work. And this was in a smaller village. And they kind of like marched him into the jungle. And they bound him. They put him in this shed. He had to spend the night there, sitting upright on a chair. And the next day, when they took him to meet the boss of the guerrilla group, he walks into this room, and it's his friend from childhood. So then it was just, he describes it as like the strangest, you know, meeting that you can imagine. Because he's terrified. He doesn't know when he's going to see us again. And this guy who used to be his childhood friend is like, Gilberto, how have you been? Like, it's so good to see you.
Sorry we kidnapped you.
So they let him go after that.
So that's lucky. My God. And, you know, like the guerrillas, and forgive me for not having like a super sophisticated understanding of the Colombian political situation back then, but like the guerrillas were agitating against the government.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted power.
They're left leaning. And they were reacting against, the government being centralized and people being corrupt and stealing a lot of money. And the government not taking care of, farmers or people who have lower income.
This doesn't sound half bad.
Yeah.
But the kidnapping thing, though, it's like the means.
Yeah. And they also got into the drug trade as a way to fund their war.
Enter Pablo Escobar,
mm-hmm.
Who, you know, I think most people are familiar with, at least like the general lore. But growing up in Bogota and... you know, in that particular time period, and also doing research, I would imagine, for your book, and really trying to get immersed and to get a full grasp of the nuance of it. You know, how large as a child did Escobar loom in your imagination? Was it there? Were you sort of insulated from it, or is it something that you only came to understand like in retrospect?
He was everywhere, but I think that as kids, we didn't understand really who he was or, you know, what was going on with the guerrillas. I don't think any of us understood as children what the difference was between the left-leaning guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitary. We didn't know why they were fighting. And we didn't really know what role Pablo Escobar had in all of it. But he was, you know, ever present, and we knew the name. And I remember one of the things that we used to play as children was we would play like Pablo Escobar and Cops. So like you play maybe like Cops and Robbers here. So that would be our version of that.
And like, so was he generally considered bad?
So he was considered, so it depended on who you asked. So he was idolized by people from lower incomes, and then everyone who was like middle class and up thought that he was terrifying.
That's sort of like El Chapo.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's
yeah.
like a similar, like
it's
they
like
cult-
a folk hero.
Right. They yeah. cultivate a kind of, but I think too, they, these guys who are psychopathic in mm-hmm. their behavior, you know, that you can't deny, they cultivate that kind of Robin Hood image. As a way to maybe insulate themselves. It's, you know, that public support, they use it as leverage. And mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, he definitely, there was some of his correspondence that got intercepted when he was on the run. And one of the letters, you know, he said he made a comparison to Robin Hood and how he was trying to cultivate that image in order to have the protection of the people, which he did get, you know, when he was on the run. All the hideouts in Medellin that he had were connected to houses where he had given that house just to a random person.
Right.
And so they, when the police came, everybody kind of knew where these hideouts were, but nobody would collaborate with the police.
A, because they've been paid, or B, because they're terrified.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
one or the other, right?
Yeah.
So you rule through fear and
yeah.
Like, I was reading up a little bit before you came over, just mm-hmm. to, like, kind of refresh my memory. It's staggering how much money, at the height of his power, the Escobar, or the cartel, what was it called?
Like the Medellin cartel.
Yeah, the Medellin cartel, like, was generous, like, $70 million a day in
yeah.
cocaine, or what, I mean, that's a
I
lot
don't
of money.
Even know, like, is that more money than Colombia had? Like,
I mean, it's more money than a lot of countries have, I think,
yeah.
you know, but it's a lot of cash.
Yeah.
And it's also like, man, who's doing all that cocaine?
I don't know.
People in the United States.
Yeah, I don't think we don't have a cocaine problem.
In Colombia.
Yeah, we don't.
It's an export.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, I want to say, I should know better probably, but I do think that the United States was the biggest customer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for all this drug flow, whether it's cocaine or whether in contemporary times it's these opiates.
Yeah.
And it's like, what is going on in this country
yeah.
that we have an appetite for this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's worth asking that question. You know, why are people medicating themselves with this stuff
mm-hmm.
To this degree?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I guess I could venture some guesses, but it's not a happy story.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, on some level, I understand that in countries or just among people who don't have access to opportunity or, you know, economies of scale or whatever, that, you know, being involved in the drug trade, I understand why a person would do it. They try, I mean,
yeah, like, it's a job.
It's a way to provide, and you can mm-hmm. make a lot of money. I mean, like, I don't know. I could see how somebody with no ill intent would get involved.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, if you imagine, you know, people are trying to, you know, struggling to feed themselves and feed their families, you're struggling to even have a place that you can sleep in, to see someone who, you know, is kind of driving around in a nice car, just passing out money just because he wants it to be more equal, or, you know, that's what Pablo Escobar used to say. And there's also a story where he, at some point when the police raided where he was hiding, he went into the mountains to hide, and he happened to be with his family, and his daughter was there. So they had to like spend the night out in the forest, and his daughter got cold. So Pablo Escobar decided that they needed to make a fire to keep her warm, and they had, you know, brought with them bags of money that they didn't want the government to confiscate, so that he just, you know, made a little mountain of money and then lit it on fire.
There's more where that came from. I mean, yeah. If you're making $70 million a day, you can make you can make a money fire.
So to see, you know, for people who have been kind of like oppressed and left behind by the government, to see someone who is doing those kinds of things, so you can understand why they would idolize him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm also thinking like in an American context, like I have an 8-year-old daughter and she's grown up partly in the Obama era and then partly in this Trump era. Mm-hmm. And it's like how to protect her from what's going on right now. I don't want her to have to worry, you know, like I don't want her to be completely ignorant to the moment, but I also don't, now is not the time at 8 years old to get caught up in all of the minutia of political corruption and the dangers presented, you know, but I think she just has a general sense that Trump is bad, but I try to just keep her away from it. And do you think your parents were kind of the same way in Colombia with,
No, I think generally like South Americans will not protect children from, you know, knowing a horrible reality. I don't know if it's because it's perhaps more ever present or maybe it's inescapable.
Like you're going to run into it somehow.
Yeah. Like if you're, you know, if your uncle gets kidnapped, if your father almost gets kidnapped, if there's a car bomb that explodes,
right.
You know, and that's a few blocks away from your house and another one explodes and this one is a block away from your house. I don't think that you can protect your kid at that point.
Right.
You have to explain to them, well, you know, these people did the car bomb and, you know, these are the people that are kidnapping, and you also want your kids to be safe. So maybe in some way it's more necessary that they know. But I think in writing the book, I just became interested in how much children actually understand and how much they misunderstand. At some point I was, I went back to Colombia, and this was one moment where I think it inspired me to stick with the point of view of young people trying to make sense of a political situation. I was walking around with my cousins and two soldiers from the army happened to walk by us. And immediately my two cousins were so terrified, like the color drained from their face. They tried to hide. They ran away. So I went over to them and I was trying to explain, like, no, that's the Colombian army. You don't have to be afraid of the Colombian army. And my aunt came over and she was like, oh yeah, they can't tell the difference between the army or the guerrilla or the paramilitary. It's just men with guns.
Right.
And that just struck me as so tragic to be at this point in your life where you're the most vulnerable and you can't make sense of the political situation that surrounds you. That was one of the things that I explored at length in the book is, those funny misinterpretation of like a vastly complicated political conflict that even adults have problems like trying to make sense.
Yeah. But there's also like a simplicity like a purity to the perspective of young people where it's not layered with these more unnecessary complexities. You know, kids have a way of seeing things truly. I don't know. Like, I feel like there can be some wisdom to that, especially when you get into situations where adults have screwed things up massively and gotten embroiled in intractable conflict.
Yeah, like in the most simple terms, those are just men with guns, right? So that is that's where that comes from.
I mean, and men with guns are scary, right? Like, I don't want to see a man with a gun.
Yeah.
I was just reading yesterday on Twitter. It was like a thread from some woman in Alaska, if I'm recalling this correctly, where she was like, don't let people tell you that guns are safe and that it's just about responsible gun ownership. She's like, we're in Alaska, which is like a land of the gun, you know, tons of people who hunt. And her husband and daughter were sitting in a restaurant and some older guy had a gun that he thought was not loaded, I guess, that he pulled out and it like went off and like a bullet ricocheted around the restaurant. And like, I mean, there was like gunpowder or something like that like wound up like on her daughter's computer. And it was very close, but thankfully she didn't get injured or anything. But I was just like, what is the allure of weapons. Why are people fetishizing this stuff? Like, just put them away. Like,
I don't know.
I have no interest.
Have you ever fired a gun?
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah. And it was terrible. And it scared me. And, like, scared me the first time. I was like, yeah, I don't like this. And I also didn't like the power. Like, I fired a my buddy and I took his grandfather's World War II rifle, which it took these, like, enormous bullets. And it was one of those bolt-action rifles. And I grew up in the Midwest and in Indiana, and there was this place called Don's Guns. And he used to have commercials. He probably still does. I think he might be dead. But he had these commercials where he's like, I don't want to make any money. I just love to sell guns. Like, that was his tagline. And these commercials were sort of famous. And he had this place. It was like kind of like a warehousey space not far from where I lived. And you could just go in there and shoot. There, you know, target shooting. And my buddy and I went over there. We were 15 years old with a bolt-action rifle. And they were like, sure. No parents. And I just remember shooting once or twice, and like the sound and the kickback and that power, like, was just a little scary. And then in college, a buddy of mine had like a 45 pistol, and we drove up. I went to college in Colorado. We drove up into the canyon and set up some beer bottles and were firing it. And I just remember like holding it and just being like, I could turn this on myself and just end my life. Mm-hmm. Or I could turn it on any one of these people and end a life. Like, that's too much power in my hands. And then just the sound and the whole project of it just felt off to me. I don't understand how somebody, picks up one of those machines and it's like, this is fun. I like this. Mm. But, you know,
I think the only kind of close encounter that I ever had with guns was in a celebratory moment. So when I would visit my family, who lived in Cucuta, which is it's bordering Venezuela. So whenever it was the new year, we would set off fireworks. And then one of the things that my uncle liked to do was to take the rifle and then fire into the jungle.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah. So it was very celebratory. But I, you know, don't remember ever wanting to see it up close or even to touch it or even to do that.
Yeah, I guess I'm fascinated by people who are drawn to it as recreation.
Yeah.
Like, and even hunting. Like, I sort of get that it's a family tradition, but like, what's the joy?
Yeah.
I'm going to go like field dress a deer.
Well,
like,
you know what I started hearing was from a lot of friends after the election. A lot of my...
Which election?
After the Trump election.
Okay.
A lot of women that I know started to take... they just started to go to gun shooting ranges.
That's actually fine. Ladies should arm themselves.
It was how else do you feel empowerment but by this, you know, action?
Yeah, I mean, I get it. And there are people who are living in dangerous places where they want a gun for protection. And it's hard to argue that. It's, you know, if you're a woman living alone in a neighborhood where there's lots of, assault and crime and break-ins and stuff like that, I kind of get it. But
yeah,
I just hate the idea that...
They're too easy to get.
Yeah. Like, you shouldn't be able to go to Kmart and get like a semi-automatic gun.
Mm-mm.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
Is there any place else in the world that does that? Is Colombia, can you get a gun that easily in Colombia?
I have no idea. I don't know. Okay. I'm sure it's easy on the black market.
Right. Well, it's easy on the black market here too. Go to a gun show or, you know, ask, like, I'm sure if you went to a gun show and talked to somebody, you could buy 100 guns out of the trunk of a car pretty easily.
Yeah, it's insane.
Well, okay. So to go back to Colombia and Escobar, the violence, the kidnapping, the extortion, the political conflict, like, all of this is not only the backdrop to your novel, but it's the backdrop to your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And you were raised middle class in a gated neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
Like the one that Chula, I mean, there's a lot of crossover, I would imagine. And you never yourself felt like, were you ever in immediate danger? Did you ever have a situation where you felt like, oh my God, I'm about to be kidnapped?
Yeah, I did. I was in that situation.
Can you explain?
Well, it's hard to explain without, because I kind of used the skeleton of it to write the book, so it's hard to explain without giving away major plot points in the novel.
Got it.
Even when I was, you know, going back to do some research for the book, there were some times where I had to, you know, go to a smaller town and I had to drive through guerrilla occupied territory.
So, yeah, what's the circumstance now? I mean, Escobar's long dead.
Yeah.
The political situation in Colombia has changed.
Yeah. So our biggest guerrilla group, FARC, put down their weapons last year.
Right.
And we still have one other guerrilla group, which is the ELN.
Lots of acronyms in Colombia.
Yeah. There's so many.
I can't keep track. But I do remember reading about FARC. I remember that made the news in the States, mm-hmm. which is saying something because our news media very rarely covers, it feels like, political strife in other countries. I feel like it's all about the horse race here. Mm-hmm. But I do remember when FARC disbanded or laid mm-hmm. down its weapons.
Ever since I've been young, there's been the peace talks, and they never amounted to anything. So it's funny to see something finally happen because, you know, I remember there was a moment in the 90s where it seemed like FARC was going to put their weapons down, and there were all these grand gestures. So some FARC soldiers, you know, had all their weapons melted, and they made statues in, like, you know, small city centers of...
This sounds great. This is what I want with our weapons. Let's melt them and make statues.
But then, you know, it wouldn't happen. And they would, you know, go back to being part of the guerrilla group and, you know, warring against the government. For something to finally happen feels amazing. And I think, but Colombia has been at war for so long. I don't know if anybody remembers what it's like to not do that anymore.
Right.
Because, you know, before the current war that ended with FARC putting their weapons down, there was a 10-year-old war before that. And then there was another war before that and another one before that. Mm. So to have that conflict inherited from generation to generation, at this point, do we even know how to live without violent conflict? So when we say, like, we're at peace and we're pursuing peace, like, what does that actually look like? Like, nobody can remember. So how are we going to do it?
Well, and it brings to mind, like, I'm thinking of, like, collective memory, you know, in the context of a country, mm-hmm. and also like national narrative. And it's interesting and alarming how quickly collective memory can shift. I think we're seeing that right now in America, where it's like, I worry about the thing you just talked about. Like, are people going to be able to remember the way that it was before all this started? Mm-hmm. I feel like that's sort of the project of Trump, is to move us away so people can't even remember a reality where there was the rule of law and there were cohesive, you know, institutions mm-hmm. and all these kinds of things. And then, you know, you talk about Colombia or any country, including the United States, that's trying to work its way out of darkness of one kind or another. You know, you have to start telling new stories. Mm-hmm. I actually had Steve Almond on the show, and he wrote a book called Bad Stories, which I thought was a great title. But it's all about basically trying to diagnose how we got into this mess. Mm. And it makes, I think, a very persuasive case that a lot of it has to do with narrative. Mm. So I don't know what the answers are, but I think it has to start at some point with some very gifted storytellers telling new stories and having those stories be heard.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And you know, I know that that's any time that we kind of break the silence wherever we do, I always think it's tied to an important cultural moment and a shift that you can open by just voicing something that hasn't been voiced.
Yeah. Well, I hope for everyone's sake that it happens. I wonder who those people will be sometimes. Like, mm-hmm. I wonder who's the vessel, you know? And I guess there have to be a lot of them, but, you know, the way that media is structured, you know, there are going to be some voices that are way louder than others, and we need good ones, you know, in places where the mainstream press is going to pay attention, both, you know, here, Columbia, wherever. So let's talk about the actual nuts and bolts of getting this book written. You know, you had your childhood experiences that have been with you for a while. I'm sure you've probably been thinking about writing this book, or were thinking about writing this book for a while prior to actually getting down to it.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yeah. It was always on my mind, and it was a story that I actually was trying not to tell because it was so... Well, part of it was that I, you know, being a foreigner and a person of color, I wanted to resist maybe what people expected me to write.
Here in the States.
Here in the States. But the other thing was that it was just so... There were so many emotions.
Isn't that I feel like that's a common story for writers where it's like the story that we really should tell is in many ways the one that we resist or have the most resistance to because it's painful.
You don't want to do it.
You don't want to go there.
It's not a pleasant experience. But everything that I started to write would turn to that story. So I would try to be just writing about something else, and then the characters would slowly become, you know, resemble me and this girl. And so at some point I did start to give in to that. And just be, you know, just from sheer just the persistence of it.
So you wrote this book in the States?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did you come over?
So I came over in 2002. And I was in Chicago and I was going to college.
Where did you go?
I went to Columbia College.
Okay.
There was a moment, in there when I was going through student visas and I couldn't return to Columbia. And I felt it was Christmas, there was snow and it was, you know, I didn't know what snow was. it was very cold, and everyone had gone to their families, and I was just alone.
Why Chicago? Why Columbia College?
I had a cousin that lived in the suburbs of Chicago, and so I wanted to be near family if I could. I also started by studying journalism. So that's how come I ended up there.
Got it. And did you like Chicago? Did you come to like it?
I came to like it after you know, I got used to the cold. But
yeah, the winters, my sister lives there, so I know. Yeah. And I grew up in Milwaukee, so part of my childhood. So those winters are no joke.
Yeah.
Especially coming from Bogota.
Yeah, imagine. So, it, you know, the coldest I had ever experienced was like 50 degrees.
And suddenly
so people started
below.
To tell me, like, you need a coat. And I was like, no. You know, I would like see the weather and it would be like 48 or something. And I'd be like, no, I think I'm fine. I'm fine. I don't need a coat. Just not understanding that it was going to get colder and what that meant. And I just... remember spending all my money on one coat, then selling that, then buying another coat, and just never finding a way to be hot enough. It got to the point where I had to carry with me like a fifth of whiskey.
Just numb yourself against it.
That was the only way that I could make it through how cold I was.
So were you thinking, you said you were studying journalism. So you were thinking, I'm going to be a journalist. I'm going to write for a newspaper? Or?
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't know anybody who wrote books, and I didn't think that was something that was available to me. But I knew that I wanted to write, and I really liked language and sentences and stories. But I was, you know... Back then, I want the desire to make up stories was so strong that I was just a very bad journalist because I would go out and do the assignment, do all the research, get all the material, come back. And then when it got to typing the story, I just wanted to make things up. You know, I just wanted to be
not a good quality in a journalist.
Not a good. Yeah, it wasn't working out.
So when did you start to make attempts at fiction? Like right there in school, or was it?
Yeah, it was always something that I did on the side. And at some point when I was at Columbia, I just transferred to the creative writing department.
Oh, you did? Okay.
So yeah. And then I really started to study it and do it.
And have you written books prior to this one that like didn't quite work out, or was this the first time
that that was the first one. I wrote a lot of short stories, before as a way to learn how to do it.
Was there a lot of failure?
Yeah. Yeah. There was tons of failure. I wrote stories for a long time where nothing happened, and I just couldn't understand what a story was.
Maybe that's my problem.
Yeah.
Stuff has to happen.
Things have to happen.
Oh, shit. But I feel like that's often the case. Like, we're talking about plot.
Mm-hmm.
People who write literary fiction, that's usually a place where they tend to struggle, you know, because they're so invested in character or in the interiors.
Yeah.
Was that the case with you think?
Yeah. And it was also this thing where I was trying not to write about Columbia because people kept telling me like, oh, you're from Columbia. Like you have all these stories. Like people would actually tell me like you're sitting on a gold mine. And I just kept resisting that.
You just didn't want to be typecast?
I didn't want to give in to that. I felt like I just wanted. So I just wrote so many experimental stories where nothing happened.
What do you think the resistance was? You didn't want to give into it because you didn't want to be what everyone expected you to be?
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of it was that it was just, in all my classes, I was often the only person of color. So I felt misunderstood all the time. And it felt a little corrective that people were like telling me, like, just tell the story of, you know, where you came from and like what that was like. And it almost felt like I was being asked to be a tour guide. So I think that's what I was resisting.
Got it.
And then coupled with the fact that I was, you know, also resisting this very intense story that I just didn't want to approach for emotional reasons.
Right.
So then that meant, you know, experimental fiction.
And so what about your parents? Like your parents are still in Colombia?
My parents are living in Mexico City now.
Oh, they are. Okay. So, but when you came to the States for college, you left home?
Yes.
And went abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And your folks were cool with it, and you're like, I'm studying creative writing in Chicago. It's freezing. They were on board.
They were on board when it was journalism.
Right.
They were like, yeah, that seems like you can make a living off that. And then when it became creative writing, they were like, what are you doing? And
you're like, Mom, Dad, I'm a poet of the soul.
Yeah.
I hate to break it to you.
But I started to work as a translator. And so I was like, see, I can make a living, I can do it, and I can do this other thing. So I did prove to them that I, you know, could support myself.
And what are they do they have any like writerly tendencies, your parents? Like what do they do professionally?
So my mom was a fortune teller.
Okay.
And then my dad was an engineer.
A fortune teller and an engineer,
yeah.
Produced a novelist. Somehow that makes sense to me.
Yeah. And you know, in my house, there were the books that we had were encyclopedias, a lot of esoteric books, and then a lot of books about communism.
Were your parents communists?
My dad was when he was young.
But then
he was very active.
But then gave it up.
Yeah. But you know what is, we as a family, we told a lot of stories. And so we had, you know, all these nights where we just sit around.
But isn't that part of Colombian culture?
Yeah.
Like I remember reading interviews with Gabriel Garcia Marquez and talking about like, you know, I think it was, this was years ago, but he was talking about magical realism and the element of the supernatural and the oral storytelling traditions of Colombia and, you know, in his family. So that's something that's like, that spans the whole culture.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we love stories. It's our favorite pastime, is to just tell stories out loud. So I think that's where it came from.
And your mom was a fortune teller? Is a fortune teller?
She was.
So,
she was. She doesn't do it anymore.
Was she psychic?
I don't know if she would describe herself that way, but I would describe her that way.
I think some people... See, I believe in that stuff. I don't think anybody bats 1,000.
Uh-huh.
I've never met anybody, but I visited a psychic twice once like the day before I left for college and once in my late 20s. And she got stuff right that she couldn't possibly have gotten right. Mm-hmm. She also thought like John Kerry was going to win the 2004 election. And, you know, yeah. So you swing and miss sometimes. but I think there's something to it. I think it's, mm-hmm. I'm not one of these people who would just dismiss it out of hand.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen her tell people things that I'm like, she's going to get slapped in the face. Like, that's way too personal. And it's like, so she's going out on a limb. Like, why would you ever say something like that to someone?
You're like, mother, we're in a restaurant. It's our waitress. Yeah. And she's like, by the way.
Yeah. And then the person is, you know, I just saw so many people just kind of like break down and be like, yeah, that is exactly what's happening in my life. And I need help, you know? So I saw things like that happen so much.
And did you inherit any of this?
You know, the only time that I've done anything like that was when I was young and I was surrounded by five cousins who are all brothers. And something just came over me and I just went around and I was like, you're going to get married at this age, you at this age, you at this age. And I told them their ages when they were going to get married, forgot about it. And then years later, when I received an email from the youngest of the brothers, and they were like, and he wrote saying, we all got married at the ages that you said, and I'm getting married this year. And that's when you said I would get married.
So they remembered.
So that's the thing with psychics is it that it's you're telling the future, or is it that I give you an age and then that's in your mind and then you force that to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that might be some part of it, but like both of my sessions were taped. I still have a cassette tape in my car. There's my daughter right there. I have a cassette tape in my car of the 2004 session, I guess it would have been. And I don't know. There's some things maybe like that. Other things are just uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the specificities.
Yeah.
This was before I met my wife. She knew her hair color, like with an unusual level of description and nuance.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think there's something to it.
Yeah. So well, you know, there was a moment where, so there was a point in when we were living in Bogota that my mom had this dream where she was in this church and she walked up to the front of the church and there was a casket. My father was in the casket and she just looked down on him and noticed the tie that he was wearing. When she opened her eyes, my dad was getting ready for work and he was standing at the foot of the bed. And he was putting on the same tie that she saw in the dream. So she was immediately like, oh shit, he's going to die. But she didn't tell him. She told us about the dream.
How old were you?
I think I was 13.
Okay. That's heavy news from mom.
Yeah. So yeah. So South American parents do not protect children at all.
What do you think? But what's the better approach? Cause like
right.
I want to be honest with my kids too. I feel like you can do damage by trying to insulate too much.
Yeah.
It's less about wanting to hide stuff or be sneaky or withhold the truth and more about just like that protective urge or something. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of time to be immersed in the bullshit of politics.
I mean, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And she lives in Los Angeles. She's seeing plenty of darkness. So, you know, there's a lot coming at her anyway, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. And so I'm also curious about your dad's communism because, mm-hmm. you know, we live obviously in this like, I think dysfunctional hyper-capitalist country in the United States. And I feel like the pendulum needs to swing back left. Pretty badly. I think that's in evidence, you know, at least in terms of our political organizing principles. But I also know, and I'm, you know, you grew up with this, like there can be perils on the left too, which mm-hmm. I think people on the American left don't necessarily always fully acknowledge. It can go dark on that side of the spectrum as well. Like there can be injustices and corruptions and big problems there too. We just haven't quite seen that, I don't think, in the mm-hmm. United States in my lifetime. And so you know, as I sort of suss it out in my head, I'm like, wow, how do we get to a more like collectivist mindset in this country where we don't place such enormous emphasis and value on the individual and on me and mine, you know, and how much can I accumulate and get your hands off my stuff and like that whole, you know, attitude. But at the same time, you know, if you get too collectivist, then there can be concentrations of power and corruptions in that way that manifest in a kind of a weird mirror imagey kind of way. So out of my own curiosity, I'm just curious, like for somebody who was communist and was reading up on it and was really influenced by it, but then to move away, like how far did the pendulum swing for your dad? Like where did he go to?
All the way.
So now he's like right wing?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, he's not right wing, but he's he believes in capitalism. But there's moments where I think we went, we were traveling somewhere in Mexico and we went to this very showy church and there was like a lot of gems and gold inside the church. And then right outside there were people that were begging for money. And there was this moment where my dad like looked at me and he was like, it's crazy that there's this building with so many ornate valuables and right outside, you know, which is, what is that for?
Right.
And then right outside there's people who are struggling to eat. Like that's crazy.
That's right. So yeah, I mean, I'm kind of like right now I do like, there's gotta just be some happy median.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's gotta be a tension point between the two that gets close to, I think like a little left to center is probably better. I think you should err on the side of collectivism if you're going to lean in one direction, but just not too far.
Yeah.
And that there could be some sort of hybridized approach that doesn't totally discredit capitalism, but also doesn't totally discredit the reality that we're all in this together.
Yeah.
Like, why can't we make some sort of adult compromise on this that makes sense so that people aren't sleeping in the street or begging, you know, for food? And,
yeah,
you know, there's just got to be a better way.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer, but
I don't know either. But yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
So you start to write this book. Like you're working as a translator? Is that what you're doing at that point?
Yes. Yeah.
And so like nights, weekends, early mornings, like how did it happen?
I was working in the mornings cause that's when I work best.
Like how early?
I usually get up and I do this now, at around 7 and start writing at like 8. And do that for 3 hours.
What happens between 7 and 8? Like just eating?
I have this kind of belief that if I repeat the same actions in the same way, that it'll convince me to stay seated in front of the desk.
Like what? Like
so just, you know, I like always like put on the same clothes. Well, I have a few outfits that I like rotate between.
I get that. It's like a writing costume.
Yeah.
It's like your uniform.
I put on the costume.
Right.
I go to the kitchen. I always make tea in the same way. It's always in the same process.
What kind of tea?
Well, actually, when I started, it was coffee, but now it's matcha.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like I've tried, what do you sweeten it with? Anything or do you just?
No, I'm just there for the caffeine.
That's it.
Yeah.
So austere.
I know.
But I'm very, cause I'm sort of cut from the same cloth. Like I'm all about like creature of habit and I think there is something to like ritual and discipline and like,
yeah.
And I think a lot of writers are this way, especially when you're the only person really enforcing any discipline
exactly.
on your work.
Yeah.
Like to have these sorts of rituals is kind of like an insurance policy.
It prepares your mind. And if you do the ritual in the same way, by the time that you sit down, you've already invested so much time in getting ready to write that it feels impossible to get up and walk out.
And so it's a 3-hour session,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking.
Yeah.
And the dictionary, did I read this correctly?
Yeah. So I usually start by opening the dictionary and pointing to a random word. And then,
by the way, I feel like this is your mother's influence on you somehow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the ways in which I started to really be interested in storytelling was that I would go to my mother's attic, or to the attic in our house, which was her fortune telling business. And I would just, when she was bored and there was no one there to see her, she would give herself tarot readings. And she, I was just so enamored with the way that she would flip over a card and it would reveal a new aspect of her life. So it would be, oh, this is me when I was young. And then she would flip something else and it, the story would slowly develop according to what she was flipping over. And so I think of the dictionary in a similar way, where it's just like you're turning over something that is random and doesn't come from you.
So how does it work? You open the dictionary, you look at a word, mm-hmm. and then you use that word as like a springboard to like some sort of free writing exercise?
Yeah. Yeah. So I will usually write two fictions and then a truth.
Like sentences.
Like paragraphs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So give me an example. Can you recall an example of a word that you looked at in the writing process for this
recently?
Novel?
Oh, for the novel?
Or recently. Like I'm
for the novel. I don't remember that. I mean, that's so long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, like I'm just thinking, like, was there one word that really like cracked the code for you or like opened the door into the world of the book? Or was it just sort of that slow grind?
It was that slow grind. And there were things that, you know, became essays from, you know, that sprung from that. There were scenes in the book, in the novel that sprung from that. And there were other paragraphs that are just, you know, lost and will never become anything.
Right. And thank God, right?
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to write the book?
So it was probably six or seven years.
And how many, like just draft after draft, or like were you working consistently in that like ritual every day pretty much for those 6 years? Or were there periods where you kind of...
There were periods where I just, life, things happened, got in the way, and I wasn't able to write.
Work stuff?
Yeah. And I also took some years off to start another book, and then came back to the novel.
What was the other book?
So the other book is the one that I'm working on now, which is a memoir.
Okay. A memoir about?
So it's a memoir about my grandfather, who was a curandero, which means faith healer.
Oh.
And people said that he had the power to move clouds. So when you say this thing about, you know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez and oral storytelling and the supernatural and how close that is to life for Colombians, that's exactly what the memoir is about.
So, okay. So curandero, like a shaman.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah. I've been reading about, I have books. There's a book right here. Shamanic Voices right here on my desk.
Yeah, there you go.
But I'm interested in like indigenous peoples and like these traditions mm-hmm. that... you know, feel very far from American culture, but I think there's a lot of merit. You know, I think people, I think it's possible that some people do have some kind of deeper level of connectivity with the natural world mm-hmm. and might have the ability to move clouds. Like I have the ability to be open to the possibility that that's real. Like, you know,
I want to live in that world, right?
Yeah.
Like, that seems a better world than living in a world where that can't happen.
I agree. I mm-hmm. also think that I am mistrustful of narrowing my field of possibility too much and looking at the world and thinking like, oh, I got this. Like there's no yeah. way, you know, like who am I to say?
I know.
You know, I think that there is something to be said for like the scientific method and rationality and evidence-based procedure and all that kind of stuff. But I think there also has to be some room in our existence for some magic.
Yeah.
Because what the fuck is this? You know, like really, like what is it? Like, it's kind of incredible that this is all happening. And
I think that every day.
Do you really?
What the fuck is this?
Yeah, right. That's your first line in your free writing exercise.
Yeah.
So your grandfather was a curandero. Did you know him well?
He died. He passed away when I was 1 year old.
Okay. But you heard stories, obviously.
I heard stories. So what happened was he was supposed to pass down the knowledge to one of his sons, but he didn't think that any of his sons could have the knowledge. So what he said about them was that they didn't have the testicles.
Really?
To be a curandero.
Harsh, Dad.
So harsh.
So, okay, so when you say curandero and you say faith healer, were there like plant medicines and mm-hmm.
There were plant medicines. There were prayers. There were you know, concoctions. Sometimes he would just pray over water and then give water to someone, and that was the medicine.
What about like psychedelics?
I don't know.
So it's not like an ayahuasquero or something?
No, no, no.
Not like that?
No. It was just more, you know, this plant is good for this. And
it's like a naturopath.
Yeah. But he also, so he had a business card, which is fun.
Do you still have it?
Yes. Oh. I have it, yeah. So it says Rafael Contreras A, that's his name. Homeopath, which is a polite word for curandero.
Okay.
And then it would say, cures you of all kinds of diseases, diabetes, obesity, cancer, and witchcraft.
He can cure you of witchcraft?
Yeah.
How do you know how?
I mean,
because he didn't pass it down. He didn't pass down the knowledge.
Yeah. Well, so what happened was that the only person he thought could have the knowledge was my mom. But she, you know, is a woman. And so it wasn't allowed for some reason.
It's a patriarchal situation.
Yeah. But then my mom had an accident where she fell down a well. And she lost her memory for 8 months.
How old were you when this happened?
Well, she was young when this happened. She was maybe like eight years old. But when she came back too, and she like recovered her, you know, all her memories came back. She could hear voices, and she could see ghosts. So then the family was like, he wasn't allowed to teach her, but the teachings just kind of came to her through this accident. And then I had an accident where I, you know, lost my memory.
What happened?
I was riding my bike in Chicago, and somebody opened their car door just slammed into it. I wasn't wearing a helmet. It was stupid.
That's how I ride my bike in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I guess I got to ride. Everyone always tells me to wear a helmet.
Yeah, wear a helmet.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But so then I lost my memory for eight weeks. And when...
Like, so amnesia is the diagnosis.
Yeah.
You're like Jason Bourne.
Exactly. I'm trying to figure out who I am. I'm paranoid.
Okay. Do you remember, if you lost your memory, you lost your previous memories, but now that you've regained your memory, do you remember what it was like to not have your memory?
Yes. Yeah.
What was that like?
It was, I don't think I've ever been happier in my life.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Did you know your name? Like what level?
I didn't know my name. I didn't know what I looked like. At some point, I didn't know if I was a woman or a man.
This is more like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind than Jason Bourne, actually.
I guess so.
Like the weight of all of that psychic baggage is just gone.
Yeah, it was just, all I knew was that I was in this adult body, and that every possibility was open to me. And I wasn't rooted in anything. And so it was just very freeing, and it was just joyous.
Were you institutionalized?
No.
No, but I mean, like, no, what do you do with somebody who's got amnesia? You let them go home?
Well, I decided that I liked that feeling so much that I didn't want anybody to fix it. So I didn't tell anybody that I didn't have a memory or that I didn't know who they were.
This is not a conversation I expected to have. See, this is why I like to do this show. So you get into this bike accident. You hit your head pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
You have no memory of the accident, I would imagine.
I didn't remember. Like, I remembered hitting the door and flying in the air, and I remembered hitting my head, but I couldn't remember where I had come from.
Where did you have like a bump or a bruise? Like where did you hit your head? Like what part of your head?
I think it was the back. It was the back of my head.
Okay.
And it was this strange feeling where I feel like I felt my brain actually like slosh. Yeah.
Okay. What part of Chicago were you in?
I was somewhere. Where was I? I was on Madison and Halsted.
Okay. I'm trying to, I don't know. I wish that's like one of those times where you ask that question and you're like, I don't even know where I am.
Why did I ask that?
Like, I'm suddenly going to be like, oh, Madison and Halsted. But I might, like, what part, like north side, south side?
It's by the river. And it's, I think it's,
Like downtown?
Yeah, it's close to downtown, yeah.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I have been by Madison and Halstead. Who knows? So you hit your head. You have amnesia. Are you taken to the hospital?
So what happened was my first idea was that I should marry someone with money. And I was like, it just started to hatch this plan where I was like, if I just stand by a building where rich people work, somebody's going to come out and, you know, they're just going to love me.
How did that work out? Did you do it?
I started to do it. Well, then I thought that actually I should go and try to get on a boat and just, you know, I don't know, become a sailor. This was my idea.
So wait, and this is in the immediate aftermath?
This is in the immediate aftermath.
No trip to the doctor?
No.
You just like got up, dusted yourself off.
I was like, oh, I have no memory. Cool. I should like, I can start a new life if I wanted to.
For 8 weeks.
Well, okay. So hold on. You're getting ahead of yourself. but then I was deciding between these two things and I caught my reflection off of a window that was dark. And for the first second, I thought that I had just made eye contact with another person. But then because the eyes kind of like reflected every inch of what I was thinking and going through, I understood in the next second that I was looking at myself. And it was this incredible moment where I was like, oh my God, I'm a woman. And
look at me.
Yeah.
But like, no idea what your name was.
This is what my face looks like. And it was a sense of wonder that was also hand in hand with feeling heartbroken that I didn't know where this body had been or what had happened to this body. So I think at that point I started to wanting to figure out how I could find my way back into the life that, you know, I had previously had seconds before. And I had a bag with me. So I like looked through my bag. I had a journal and I like flipped through it. Didn't recognize my own handwriting, which was so weird and strange.
You're and like, then, whoever this person is, she can really write.
Yeah.
She's a genius.
I didn't read anything too closely, actually. But I pulled out my phone and I just called the last person that I had talked to.
Oh, good.
And then
I was going to say, how did you get home?
Yeah. So I was like, hey, how's it going, Jeff? Because that was the name. I didn't know who they were.
He's like, I'm your doctor. Like, yeah. I'm your accountant. Why are you calling me?
Yeah. It was my brother-in-law.
Okay.
So he was like, oh, you know, like, have you talked to your sister? And I was like, no. And I actually told him, like, I actually just fell off my bike. And he asked, oh, have you called Jeremiah, which I found out was my fiancé at the time. So, you know, I hung up with Jeff. I called Jeremiah, and he came to get me. And he took me to the ER, but at the ER, you know, they scanned my brain. The doctor was like, so it looks like you have a concussion. Are you having trouble remembering things? And I was like, no, I remember things perfectly. Like, I'm good. Like, I know everything. But the doctor told my fiancé that that night he had to wake me up every half hour and ask me questions that I would know the answer to. Like, where are you born? You know, where were you born and what year is it? And these were all things that I didn't know.
Wow.
So,
this could be like a movie. I feel like this is like a rom-com or something, like a woman with amnesia in the city. And then eventually, I mean, 8 weeks is a pretty long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm imagining that the intensity of your memory loss was receding over mm-hmm. the course. It wasn't like some snap and suddenly it all came back.
Yeah. Every time that I went to sleep and woke up, something would return. So the memory came back in little bits and pieces.
Did you have post-concussion syndromes that were, like, unpleasant, like, physically? Like, were you headaches and all that kind of stuff?
I felt really, really tired. And I would also just get panic attacks. But I don't know if it was from, you know, the secret that I was keeping or if it was a side effect of the
And the secret being that, like, I actually love this and I don't remember anything?
Yeah, and I don't want to remember. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry your memory came back. Like, yeah. Condolences. I sort of get that, though. That would be, in a weird way, like, super liberating. And
yeah.
I imagine, like, experiencing life with... And everything seems sort of new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, you know, wonderful. It was just amazing experience.
Wow. Are you going to write about it?
Yeah. Oh, so when my family found out that I lost my memory and when it came back, they were like, oh, can you see things like your mom could? And do you hear voices now? Or do you have prognostic dreams? And, you know, none of those things happened for me. So the whole family was, like, disappointed. They were like, oh, you know, like, you went through
She's
the same.
She's a failure.
Yeah. You had the accident like your mom and you lost your memory like your mom. Like, what happened?
Well, I think there's a difference, though, in that your mom being stuck in the bottom of a well was probably traumatized by her accident. Whereas, like, you popped up mm-hmm. and you were like, this is lovely.
Yeah.
Your kid being at the bottom of a well.
Yeah.
That's
intense.
Yeah. That's a trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But you weren't traumatized.
I wasn't.
You were traumatized by your memory coming back.
Exactly.
Wow. That's incredible. So is this going to work its way into a book?
Yeah,
I know that you have sort of like this resistance to people telling you that you're sitting on a gold mine, but I feel like this is a good story.
Yeah. So this it's going to be part of the memoir about my grandfather, because it's all a story about what gets inherited and kind of like repeating stories across generations. So there's just weird parallels with me and my mom, but also with my mom and my grandfather. So it's all kind of a family memoir about memory and the supernatural.
What do you mean about parallels? From generational parallels? Like sort of mm-hmm. like you hitting your head, your mom falling down the well?
Yeah.
You think these things repeat?
Well, they did repeat. What do you mean?
I don't know. I mean, like, but I mean, like, do you think that it's like that's a thing? Like, like not just with you, but with all people, that like we have like echoes from one generation to the next, and that if certain things happen to one generation, they're more likely to repeat themselves.
It feels that way, doesn't it? Like there's it almost feels like if there's some unresolved, you know, something with your father, sometimes it feels like you start to tread on those same issues.
Yeah. I guess
so. I feel
so.
Like on some level that happens to everyone.
Well, and like, you know, this interconnectedness thing, like the reality is that you are your grandfather mm-hmm. on some level. Like his DNA right. is your DNA and his being is deeply tied into yours. Like mm-hmm. it's all in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And so on back through infinity. Like, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So I guess there's some sense to that, which makes me sit here wondering, like, what's coming for me?
Yeah. You're like, what have I not lived yeah. through that well, yeah, my parents were not able to solve?
Right. Or like my great-grandparents or, you know, uh-huh. God knows what happened back in the day. But
yeah.
So you're working on this memoir and, like, having written a novel. I mean, I guess the novel's also in an autobiographical vein, but mm-hmm. you have a lot more latitude to play with narrative. Like, do you have lessons learned from having worked in both modes? And is there one that you prefer?
I did. I think I learned so much about how a story can be told across many pages. And I think that's maybe the hardest thing to learn as a writer. Because, you know, everyone starts with a short story. And you learn how to balance tension and conflict in a few pages.
Speak for yourself. I'm still working on it.
But with longer work, it's learning how to do that and how to sustain that is one of the hardest things that I had to figure out how to do.
Do you outline?
I like to write a first draft where I don't plan. I just kind of let the story lead me. I mean, going back to that idea of turning over tarot cards and letting something random dictate where you go.
Mm.
I try to do that when I'm writing. I just try to let myself be open and just kind of hear into the void of what I'm writing to and let that.
What do you mean dictate? What you're writing to? Because like,
yeah,
I say this because I lately have been like, you know what? I'm just going to show up. I'm going to show up. I'm starting to write by hand now just to like remove myself from the computer where mm-hmm. I'm way too likely to like get onto the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I just show up and I just let myself write. Whatever I want to write about, I can write about. It's basically just like journaling. And I'm like, this feels good. I'm getting work done. I'm getting words on the page, but there's no unifying theme. I'm not telling a story. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, when you say you're writing to something, like, do you have some sort of structure in your mind or some sort of plot or character or some organizing principle around which you're letting yourself be free?
I think it always starts with there's some conflict that feels that it can't be solved easily. And once I have that, what it looks like is I'm just sitting in front of the computer and I'm just staring off into space and I'm trying to keep my mind blank, and then something will come from that. I mean, it's a weird process. It's like hard to...
you have to let your subconscious do some of the work. Like, it's all kind of lurking down there and you have to kind of get out of your own way.
Mm-hmm.
But you seem like you can do that.
Yeah.
And you've created your little method. I like that. I like that you've created, like, everybody does it kind of their own way. And I think that, you know, there's certain similarities, but I love when someone's like got like a system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have my matcha and wear one of these outfits, sit in this chair.
It's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, no, discipline equals freedom. That's, I always joke to my wife about that. I'm always, because I get up at like ungodly hours.
You do? What time?
Like 4:30.
Oh, why?
Just because it's the only time I can have to myself without any guilt over being like neglectful dad, or, you know what I'm saying?
Okay,
like,
yeah.
If I want to go hiking, or I want to write, or I want to exercise or read, or, you know, like, that's my time.
Mm.
And I know that no one is like secretly like sitting in another room going, wish dad was here. You know, I don't know. But I also feel like I get more done and I just feel better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I like to get up. I like to see the sunrise.
Mm.
Like, that's a big deal to me.
Mm.
I'm like, I don't want to miss that. Like, that's a good moment in the day.
Mm.
And I like, especially living in a loud, like, noisy, crowded city, I like how quiet it is. Like, I'm sort of hungry for some solitude, but also just like some quiet.
Yeah.
That's the only time to get even like some semblance of it in Los Angeles.
Quiet is so important when you're trying to write.
It's important, period.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying you have to live in some sort of like void, but if you have not experienced any kind of silence recently, like, it's worth seeking out because it's lovely.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I have noise canceling headphones. Yeah.
She's actually wearing them right now in case you notice a delay. So you're working on this memoir. How close to being done are you?
I have a hard time starting a project if I don't know what the beginning is. So I've been working, did all the research for the book, did all the interviews, you know, did all the travel. And I've, for the 2 years that I've been working on it, I've just been trying to find the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I have about, maybe like 100 pages that are different beginnings of different scenes that I thought could be the beginning of the memoir. And just this past December, I found the real beginning.
Are you willing to share
what the real beginning is?
Yeah.
So it starts with this idea of inheritance, and I don't know. It's hard to explain now that you've put me on the spot.
I think starts with an idea. I think inheritance as the theme to begin with makes some sense.
Yeah.
And whether or not, you know, what do you inherit from your, I think about it in the sense of like, how much is genetically predetermined versus how much like free will and control over my own situation do I have? And you know what I'm saying? Like, how much are you boxed in by what's passed down to you? And then, you know, on a more like supernatural or magical level, like what generationally needs to get worked out from one to the next, and is there some like larger fabric that we're all woven into, and is this more of a group project than might immediately meet the eye? I know the answer to the question from your perspective is that, like, from generation to generation, we're all connected and we're working out things from one to the next.
I think so. I think sometimes you want that connection to happen and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes it does. So I don't think there's an absolute way that you inherit everything. But you know, one of the things that it seemed to me when I was thinking about writing the book that it was one of the reasons why it was like hard to tell the story was because it was so far into the past. But one of the things that happened was that my two aunts and my mom had the same dream. So it, you know, independently of each other, like the same week, they dreamt the same thing.
Which was?
My grandfather coming to each of them saying, I want my remains dug up and I want them moved. So because that happened and it was like a shared dream, we decided that we needed to go and do that.
Wow.
So that's actually the beginning of the memoir. It's just this shared dream has happened, and then we're all going to travel and do that in Colombia.
That's a good beginning.
Yeah, right? I'm pretty happy with it.
Well,
I think it'll work.
That's incredible. This dream, this shared dream.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and now you live in San Francisco.
Yes.
How'd you get there? You were like, I just got to get out of this cold.
Yeah, part of it was just the winter was too much. And my partner started to go to grad school in the Bay Area, so that's why we moved. And then once we were in nicer weather, I was like, why go back?
You know, right. That's how I feel about like leaving LA. It's like, I'm always like, where else would we live? And I'm like, I don't know if I'm so used to not having to deal with weather.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like such a dumb thing to say, but I'm like, I'm not sure if I can deal with weather. And I grew up dealing with it, so I'm sure I could figure it out, but I'm in no rush.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. You live in San Francisco. You've had a great publication success with this debut. You're working on a memoir. It's got a great beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You have your memory back.
Yeah.
Or at least most of it. And then you went on Seth Meyers. If we're going to bring this full circle, I guess mm-hmm. I should ask, like, how large is my face? Like, what are you seeing here? Is it an overwhelmingly large face or is it okay?
I think it's average. It's average size.
You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. Well, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I appreciate you taking the time to come over and talk with me. And again, congratulations.
Thank you so much. It was so fun to come talk to you.
Okay, that is Ingrid Rojas Contreras. Her debut novel, Fruit of the Drunken Tree, is available now from Doubleday Books in hardcover. You can find her online at ingridrojascontreras.com. You can follow her on Twitter. Her handle there is @Ingrid_Rojas_C. Ingrid Rojas Contreras, Fruit of the Drunken Tree. Go get your copy immediately. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. If you would like to support this show, patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to write to me, letters@otherppl.com. Tell me a story. Let me know what you think. Don't forget about the Other People app. This podcast has its own official app. It's free. All episodes of this show are free. Go get it. It's all there. Next week on the program, I forgot to mention this at the top of the show. I think I'm going to start telling you who's on the following week. Just give you a preview. Next week on this program, I have Duke Haney. He's got a new essay collection out. It is wonderful. It is called Death Valley Superstars. If you like Hollywood, if you like artists with like a very strong rebellious streak, if you like film history, if you like, I don't know, just great writing, it's an excellent book. A lot of it was originally published on the nervousbreakdown.com, now helmed by Joseph Grantham, the new editor-in-chief. He took over for me. Do you know that? Write to him. Send him stuff.